This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at REACH 2017, held on March 23 and 24, 2017, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Finding and refining your story. And, I'm not quite as professional as Obi made me sound. I'm figuring stuff out, and I'm helping anybody who's interested because I believe in storytelling. And so it's kind of like juggling. I don't juggle very well, but I teach juggling. And most of my students are now better than I am. They're doing 4 and 5 balls and doing more tricks than I know how because they're younger and they can see better. But the important thing is they're doing it, and then I don't have to do as much of it, I guess. Although I really like doing that. Trying to figure out how to do this. It's disturbing. I will just tell you, it's disturbing to do 2 sessions back to back here. I don't have time to sort of rewind quite. But this is what I intend to do, and then you can see if I'm any good at that. I have a story to tell, and then we're going to do a little exercise in which we'll pair off, and there'll be a lot of noise, and you'll tell each other a little story, and then I'll get the timer to time you, and I want you to just experience. I'll set it up a little bit so that you can get a feel for what I mean when I say storytelling, and then we'll have questions and answers if there's time for that. So what I'm going to start out with right now is I have a story I call School Lunches, and this takes me back to when I started school, and I was in the first grade, and it was in New Glarus, Wisconsin, and it was the public school. That's where people went, and I remember the bus coming and picking me up, and it was exciting. And most of the children ate hot lunch, and I loved hot lunch. We had trays, and there were lunch ladies, and they had hairnets, and they were big and slump stuff on, and everything, but My favorite thing ever was shoestring potatoes when I was in first and second grade. And it's kind of like eating wooden matchsticks, but we got to dip them in ketchup, and it was just wonderful. And I've tried to revisit that in recent years, and it's awful now. It's very disappointing, but at the time, that was my favorite thing. And, I'd worked my way into the sort of Yankee culture. It wasn't really Yankee, it was kind of Swiss culture in New Glarus. I remember once describing to Paul. Paul was, in my class, and he rode on the bus with me. And I was concerned that he didn't confuse me with Amish, because, the Mennonites had found us, and we weren't Amish anymore, really. I remember telling him this, and I'm feeling a little ashamed about it now. I told him that, I am not Amish, I'm Mennonite, and that's just like regular people. And the irony of this is, Paul was from a Seventh-day Adventist family. I didn't really know that. I heard my mom and dad talk about it later on. And we almost never did the Pledge of Allegiance in that school, but once in a great while we did. And when we did it, and we didn't know anything else. I stood up with the others, and I did the Pledge of Allegiance. Paul would stay he would stay seated, and he'd just put his head down on his desk until we were done. And it was pretty remarkable. I mean, I remember that vividly because I was like, what is wrong with Paul? I never asked him, but it made a deep impression, and that's how I learned from my parents that, and we talked about that. And I don't, about that time, actually, we moved. We moved to Muscadet, and there was a Christian Day school there, so we didn't have to deal with that anymore. No more Pledge of Allegiance. And I remember, I was in second grade, and my sister, who had been in kindergarten, she immediately graduated to first grade, because there was no kindergarten at Muscadet Christian Day School. And I remember we coming to school that very first day, and it was in September after school started, and I remember the schoolhouse was country and old, and there was this pump outside that you pumped to get a drink, and there were steps up and a tiny little cloakroom, And then you went around there, and there was the classroom, and that was it. That was the whole thing. And I remember opening that door. It was an old wooden door, and the row of hooks and names above each hook. And so we immediately got a name and a hook to hang our stuff on. And then around over here was a wooden table, not very big, a little bigger than this. And there were lunch pails on that table. They were amazing lunch pails. One of them had Huey, Dewey, and Louie on it. There was one that had Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And they were just like, wow. And we also saw there was a rusty old refrigerator and a rusty old electric stove. And then we went in and we got our little old desks. And then at lunchtime, I remember both my sister Rose and me, we were both totally watching to see what was in those lunch pails. And you wouldn't believe it. There were those children, they had sandwiches made with white Wonder Bread. And there was peanut butter and grape jelly, and they were cut on the diagonal. And they had little tiny Snickers bars, you know, the little ones, like two or three each. And they had potato chips. And they were not just your ordinary potato chips. They were in real potato chip bags, this size, not in baggies, in bags, the kind that would pop when you opened them. And they had, their moms sent them, they brought pop to school and put it in that refrigerator, and they drank that for their lunch. Boy, when we got home that night, my sister and I, we were like, Mom, we gave her a list. We need lunch pails with Huey, Dewey, and Louie on them. And we talked about sliced on the diagonal and pop, and candy bars. And we made, you know, we were storytellers. We did the best we could, and we thought we, you know, pitched it really well. Oh. Our mom, she looked at us, and she said, the whiter the bread, the sooner you're dead. She had no empathy. None at all. I mean, I have to explain my mom a little bit because she plays a role in this story. My mom, you know, she has opinions about the world. And, you know, when we moved, when I was just a little 2.5-year-old, we moved from Buchanan County, where I was born, to New Glarus because you could buy farms for not very much money. She was, you know, it was exciting, and my dad, and they had milk cows, and they planted garden, and then we noticed that, you know, there were some Amish people, but between them in these little tumble-down farms were hippies, we called them. They were people that came from Madison, and they had just sort of flipped out of the system, and they were trying to get back in touch with the land. And we just, you know, we would look at them as we drove by in our horse and buggy, and they were doing weird stuff, you know, trying to plant garden, and obviously didn't know how to make rows straight. And, you know, they'd have goats running around. You know, how are you going to keep a goat in with those fences? And then they'd come over to see us, and they would ooh and ah, and wow, what tomatoes you've got there. Well, yeah, you can have some. And they'd pick one off and just eat it right there. I mean, not even slicing it or salting it. And we looked at them, and they invited us over, and they had, the neighbors had a cake wheel, and they made pottery. It was just amazing. But they really didn't know much about doing milk and goats and stuff. So they'd come over and consult with my dad, and they thought he was just the smartest guy in the world because he knew which end of the cow, you know. The milk came out and where the oats went in and the horses and stuff. It was kind of like that. And they would just go on and on to my mom about, you know, how she could can things and everything. And my mom and my dad, they got kind of a big head. You know, and they were like, you know, the stuff that we do is actually pretty important. And doing a garden and putting up stuff, that's a good thing. And they started really kind of embracing it, you know. And so here we little upstarts were telling them we wanted sliced on the diagonal, Wonder Bread. No way was that going to happen. We had to suffer. My mom, she didn't think it was suffering at all. She thought it was cute. She had a wicker basket about as big as this with two handles that came up. And she put a saucepan in there, one quart, stainless steel, clang, clatter. And that was our lunch the next day. It was a quart of homemade chili. A quart, like a whole quart with a ring and everything on it. And she had half a loaf of brown bread and a knife to slice it with and a chunk of homemade butter. And there were some dill pickles and then there were those Tupperware bowls about this big, the yellow ones that made that terrible scritching noise when you put your spoon. You're not old enough. You could make a lot of racket at breakfast if all the children did that at the same time. And then, 10 minutes to noon, my sister Rose had to go out and put the saucepan on and heat that homemade chili. And then our desks were at an angle, so we had to sit in front of everybody at the class table and ladle out, you know, the stuff and clank and slice the bread. And everybody was eating their Wonder Bread sandwiches and looking at us. It was mortifying. And I remember I had two people in my grade. It was Roxanne and Donald. And they were really interested, and they came up to see what was going on here. And it's like, ew, what is that? It's homemade chili, you know, and you have to, you know, defend your family, and it's good. And Donald was like, hey, what kind of bread is that? It's homemade bread. It's whole wheat. It's okay. Yeah, right. I didn't think so. And, oh, it was hard. It was just terribly hard. And we came home, and we complained mightily. Oh, it was just, we can't do this, Mom. And she said, and we said, you know, we're the oddballs. Everybody else in school is eating on the diagonal. And she said, you know, if everybody jumped over a cliff, would you jump over it with them? No. Well, you know, she just didn't understand. And we had to just deal. It was suffering. And it was big suffering for a second grader and a first grader. But that's the way it was. And we got watercress sandwiches, and we had homemade cheese, and there were snails in the watercress sometimes. And we were just odd and weird, and we could do nothing about it. And I don't even know how we managed to get through those eight grades there, but we did somehow get through them. And the weirdest thing is now that I'm all grown up and everything, one of my favorite foods is my mom's homemade chili. And, you know, I don't even like Wonder Bread anymore. I like whole wheat bread. And when I find watercress, I always pick some and eat it, and it just makes me so happy. It's kind of like radishes a little bit, and it's got a wonderful, crunchy mouthfeel. You know, looking back on this, I realized that I learned important things in that grade school at Muscatine Christian Day. But maybe something even more important that I learned was from my mom. And it was that she taught my sister and me and the rest of my family, she taught us not to worry so much about what everybody else is doing and to think for ourselves. And it was a wonderful gift of education for a little first and a little second grader who felt odd and weird. And it prepared us for a life of standing out and not quite fitting in and being okay with that. And I could only wish that on all of you here, because it's not that hard to fit in. And it might be scary to look different and to stand for something that popular culture doesn't stand for. But it's a powerful spot to be in. And if you want to change people's lives, you don't want to look exactly like, let's just say, the trailer trash that you're trying to help. So that's the story I have for you. How much time do we have, timekeeper? 20 minutes. Okay, we have some time then. Good. I want to talk just a little bit about things that go into storytelling. And I'll just mention a few things, and I hope that I have time to ask for questions as well. But I want to talk about inferiority complex, and I'm going to call that shame right now. And I want to compare that with pride. And I'm going to submit to you that that is two sides of the very same coin as far as storytelling or presenting yourself in public goes. If you're proud, you're thinking about how you are coming off. And if you're trying to tell a story, that gets in the way of the story. In the same way, if you are nervous, and not necessarily nervous in a good way, you know, a few butterflies, but if you're so worried that you will be a fool, you won't do well either. Again, you're thinking too much about yourself. So to get to a place that you all want to get to, and you know, we all are storytellers, but telling stories in front of a lot of people is scary, even if it's only 10 or 12. You want to get to that place where the story is your entire focus, and presenting that is all you're thinking about. You're not thinking about, well, did I brush my teeth, or, you know, are my glasses crooked, or do I have my glasses on even? You want to be thinking about the story in the way that if you're with your friends and you're having a conversation, you shouldn't be just thinking about what you're going to say next. You should be listening to the conversation as it comes from you. And then you should be building that conversation with what comes from you and then listening again so that it's not about any one of you. It is about what's going on between you. That's what storytelling is. And so at some level, even though I'm the one who's doing most of the noise here, you're communicating with me with eye contact and with all kinds of tiny little expressions that tell me, yeah, you're getting it, or, you know, I need to tone it down a little bit, or go, you know. And so that's a really important part about storytelling, is understanding that it's an interactive thing that's going on here. So here's the thing. I started telling stories just kind of without even really thinking about it to my nieces and nephews when they were little. And they needed somebody to divert them from getting into trouble. They were running around in packs. And they were finding rotten duck eggs and throwing them against the wall, you know, of the barn. And they were breaking away. They were just getting into trouble one day. And I was out, and I was going to, like, okay, now listen here, you know. And then I had this flashback, and I remember when I was doing exactly the same thing. And I remember somebody like this, and I remember not remembering or hearing a word they said. And I realized that wasn't going to work. But I did. I diverted them. I said, do you want to hear about the time I was 2.5 years old and I escaped from the front porch naked and crawled down the road, and they all forgot about throwing rocks at me, and they just sort of herded around there like this. I've had to tell that story so often, I'm almost tired of it. But in the story, children love stories that are clear-cut, and mythology often does that. It makes people, characters all evil and all good. And so a little tiny person is not confused by nuances. They understand and they recognize that they have inside of them tendencies towards being stubborn and selfish and disrespectful. And they somehow want to hear stories about people who experience those very same emotions they have, and then they want to sort of understand how that character that is their friend now, what happens to them. And they want to hear it over and over again. And it ends up, if they like their friend in the story, they will start turning themselves in that direction and learning that particular lesson. And maybe, you know, if it's a good kid in the story, they will want to be like that person. It is where culture and morality start sort of infusing itself into a small child's life. My earliest memories start at 2.5. And in those earliest memories are my mother's voice reading out of the Bible storybook to me, the stories that children could understand, the simple ones. And it wasn't that we understand the deep nuances. It was just that it was a story in which I identified with Isaac or with somebody else. And they're in there. And I have learned from having interactions with friends at university and other places who never had that growing up. Their parents were like, well, you know, religion is okay, but we're going to let our children figure that out themselves when they grow up and can make rational decisions. And I remember Ben. Ben, he was a really close friend for a long time. He just hung out with me and this one other Mennonite guy at Yale. And he was a bright guy. He did a double major in music and astrophysics. And I liked talking with him. And we did stuff together and everything. And we talk about faith and belief. And I remember him saying, you know, finally, he said, you know, I admire you Mennonites, and I, you know, you and Arlen, I think you're wonderful people. And he even bought a pair of, I used to wear Latzhose, you know, the ones you get at Gone Brothers over in Middlebury, Indiana. He liked those, and I ordered a pair for him, and he wore those too. And he was like, you know, I could be a Mennonite, but I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist. And we talked about that a lot. We talked about that, you know, how is it that I can believe and that Ben simply can't? And it got right down to it. I believe that at least part of the way God found his way into my heart is through my mother reading stories to me even before I can remember them. But I'm just telling you, it's very important to nurture young children with the songs of our tradition and the stories of our faith. We don't want to neglect that, because we get one round at it and then they're adults and it will come to them in a very different way then. And we heard at the, I went to this why not let Wycliffe do it. We heard there, and he's right, I can't remember his name. He said, it's one thing to teach a 2-year-old our culture. It's a whole different ball game when they're 45 years old. And I know this from my own experience. I'm 55. I can't learn new stuff anymore. You know, I'll listen to you, but it's like, nah. It's, you know, that sponge part of my life, that's over with now. So that's the power in storytelling. Where are we now on time? Oh, thank you so much. Okay, this is what I want to do. I want you all to have a little bit of an experience of you know, finding your story. And the way we're going to do it is just very quickly, you know, you're just going to pair off, you know, like you would start YouTube, 222 everywhere, just so kind of identify. And what we'll do is we're going to, both of you, everybody at the same time, you're going to go back into your life, and it could be when you're a child or recently, but what you're looking for is an experience with intense emotions where you were scared, so scared, you know, that you just about couldn't go anymore, or you felt just an incredible desire for something, or you had just unbelievable joy. And you're going to look for anything that was transformative that came out of that experience. And then you'll simply, we'll give 5 minutes. One of you will do this first. You will simply introduce yourselves, and whoever is ready first, just visit it. You're not trying to perfect anything. You're just going to a place of intense emotions, and you're going to just describe that for a couple of minutes. And then we'll just stop. And then we'll switch around, and your partner will do that to you. And you're not trying to get the world's greatest story or something that, you know, you're just, this is just a simple exercise in learning what storytelling is about. So you find your partners and introduce yourselves.
I can't.
Okay, and now everybody figure out who will say it first, and just go where it is and say your story. And in about 4 minutes, we're going to stop, and then we'll do it the other way around. Okay, time. It's just a little early, but I've just been made aware that the speaker next door is losing his audio. So sorry. And so we are going to stop right there. But what you have is you have had the experience of either listening or maybe both listening and hearing to what the core of storytelling is about. And what I'd like to do, because I think we still have a minute or two, is if your partner just had the most compelling story that was just amazing, and you think it might be helpful as an encouragement for him or her to say that in front of the group or from where you are, you can volunteer them. Or you can volunteer yourself. If somebody is really brave and would just like to, and you could come up here and just talk to me and say it, and the rest could just listen, or you could do it from where you are. So is there someone like that right now?
I got one here.
Yes. We have a winner.
I guess. Can you come up here and stand in front of me and then this will
so I can't read your name.
So you want me to tell it to you or to?
If you're... You know, let me... Zachary Schrock, I'm going to wire you up. And if you can just click that where it's comfortable. And so go for it for a minute or two.
Okay, can anybody hear me? Okay, so the story was this. It was a time that I was probably the most scared I've ever been my whole life. And this happened quite a number of years ago. I was 14 years old, and I was with a small group of hikers, and we were up in the mountains in Montana. And I was at Idaho Wilderness Boys Camp. Some of you guys have heard of that. And we select a leader from the younger group of guys. We had two chiefs who were older, but they don't really interact as much with the group. During the hiking trip, each day one of the smaller guys is supposed to lead out. So this particular day, I was the day leader. And we got a late start on this hiking trip, and we had to get to our campsite, and this campsite was just up the trail a few miles, and we got such a late start that it got dark on us as we were trying to find our campsite. So we continue on, and it was just getting dark. Like, it was getting so dark that I was starting to get a little bit scared, but I had all the guys with me. It wasn't that bad, but it was getting to the point where I just could not quite see the path in front of me. And if you've been hiking before, you know what I'm talking about when it comes to get dark like that and you're on a slope. It was switchbacks, the trail. Typically the cold air starts to fall down the mountain, and I was starting to feel that on the side of my face. It was just falling down the mountain. The cold air was settling into the valley, and that's important for what happened next. What happened was, all of a sudden, out of the just in the pitch black, we weren't making any noise, just walking along, there was this scream, and the scream was so intense that everybody stopped and nobody said anything. Like, nobody had any sort of reaction. It was so intense that we just completely stopped, and I didn't know what it was. And the scream reminded me of a child that was extremely lost and just absolutely panicking, like the worst panic attack you could ever think of, and they wanted their parents. That's about how it sounded. And so I stopped, and one of the chiefs came up and came to the front of the group, and he said, I think I'll take it from here, and I'll lead you guys to your campsite. They weren't going to tell us originally. Now they were interested in telling us where our campsite was. So we were about to continue on, and the screaming came again just for a few seconds, maybe 10, 15 seconds. And it freaked me out so bad. I said, well, do we need to go back? I said, it sounds like somebody's in trouble. And it sounded to me like it was no more than about 200 feet below us. And they said, well, no, we're not going to go back. We need to actually go forward. And so I was young. I did not know what this was. And then just before we started moving, like, we were still just kind of in shock, the screaming got about three times as intense. And what happened was, it sounded that like that child who was panicking, it sounded like they were literally getting torn to pieces by a wild animal. And this is what made me just very unsettled. I was extremely at that point, I was starting to lose judgment, and I was like so freaked out. And they said, "Well, we just need to go." So we started moving, and this intense screaming and noise and fighting stopped almost instantly as soon as we started moving. And I realized later the reason is because when we're standing still, the animal couldn't smell us, but when we moved, the cold air coming down the mountain, they probably picked up our scent. And so we continued on, and we just hauled it out of there. And we got to our campsite. It was dark. We built a huge fire. And then we all came in together, and our chiefs told us what most likely happened, and that was that it was a mountain lion that was screaming, and it was probably a territorial thing, and they actually thought that it was probably either two mountain lions fighting or a mountain lion and a bear, which is extremely rare, but a fairly dangerous situation. And I will never forget that scream. Like, that scream, if you've ever heard a cougar scream, you won't forget it. And that was something that stuck in my mind for the rest of my life. We were safe. Everything was fine.
Thank you, Zachary. Now, you know, that's not the end product, but an excellent core of a story because, you know, if you were 14 ever and had your wits scared out of you, you can sort of enter into that and feel that sort of thing there. What I think I'll do, do we have a time? Okay, good. What I think I'll do is we'll just leave that, and you have got a lot of wisdom going on among you in the little stories that you were able to tell. And I encourage you to do several things here. I encourage you to pay attention to detail. And a great way to practice that is get yourself a little sketch pad with no lines on it, or even if just get one with lines and a pencil, and start drawing stuff. And as you go along where you might write out words, look at something and draw it. Look at your, you know, like you're sitting in class at AFB and, you know, it's kind of going on and on. Like, doodle. Start drawing, like, Stephen Brubaker. Like, whatever the angle is, you know, try to get his nose. One of the greatest, images of John Calvin that I know was drawn by one of his students sitting in the university, and it's just he got him so amazingly well with his long beard and his long face and his nose and everything there. But what that will do, the important thing is not that you get really good at it, but that you start noticing details. That's an important part about being a human being and doing well with other people, is noticing details. Storytelling's like that too. And then you start figuring out which ones support and which ones don't. And you start taking away and tweaking, and you focus. One person once said that, you know, storytelling is talking about, it's like creating a lens so that the light of heaven shines down through you and illuminates the people that listen to you. And so what you're doing is you're being a lens, and you're crafting things, and you're focusing so that every word supports what you want to say. And what you got from me was just, you know, maybe not such an important story, but for children it is. But, you know, it's, don't feel that, you know, I can't tell a story. You all are storytellers, and at some level, you will want to work on improving that, because it's the way that you become the lens of heaven to shine God's light to the people that you meet every day. And it might not be in front of a group like this. It might be one person, but you want to do it well for that person too. So right now, what I want to do is just ask for questions. Any questions about what we've done today in the breakout session here? Or I guess any others. I'll answer if I know. Yes?
You mentioned something about pride and shame.
Yes.
Where does shame come in?
Where does shame come in? That's a good question. Shame is, you know, what God asks of us is to accept ourselves. Our bodies are a gift from God. And they are to be presented as a gift. Not something to just like, boy, this is mine and woo-hoo. But simply there. And so shame is when we somehow have serious issues. Got it. Serious issues with who we are. It might be our psychological landscape, or it may be, just don't like my nose or whatever it is. But it's when we're obsessing about ourselves, whatever it might be. I wish I had a full head of hair. And it's kind of a practical thing. But I don't. And I'm not gonna wear a rug. This wouldn't be me. It just wouldn't. And you wouldn't believe me if I wore a rug and told you a story. And so that might be kind of an example. But the point here is, if you're doing something really important, then insofar as you can get the job done, that's great. But if you get yourself in there and you're thinking about yourself, that's brain power that is not going into fixing the diesel tractor or getting the story across or whatever else you're doing. You want to be, and that's part of why storytelling is so fun, it is being in the moment and moving along with great concentration. It is not usually multitasking. And what we find out is that multitasking is something that we sometimes do, but it really does not bring all that much satisfaction. What brings satisfaction is focusing on one important thing and doing that as well as we possibly can. That's where the tingles start going up and down the spine. And that's what we want. Thank you. Any others? Yes?
Do you ever make up fictional stories to illustrate a point?
Do I ever make up fictional stories to illustrate a point? Yes, and I don't have to make them up because they've been made up already, and it's mythology. I found books of Greek mythology when I was a little boy in the school library that nobody else was reading, and I was just swept off my feet. I just thought they were the most amazing things ever, and. Mythology is sort of stripping down and simplifying a story and in order to illuminate a truth. And there's, we have expectations, but certainly that is something that I do and I encourage people to think about doing as well. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between storytelling versus drama? Is there a difference? How does it affect the audience? Is it the same? Is it different?
The question is, what's the difference between storytelling and drama, and does it affect audiences differently? What is it? And that's a good question because historically, we have Protestants and other people who are concerned about correctly bringing the good news, have been wary. Some of them have been very wary of drama. And I guess the question exactly, what's the difference? Storytelling is actually learning stuff from drama. I'm really interested in how dramaturgs set up and how play actors do things because they're speaking with every part of their being, not just with the mouth part. And so certainly I'm doing more of that. Now, there are times when that's very appropriate and wonderful, and there are times when it isn't. And you're going to have to, it's a little dangerous, but, important things often are. And that's, I guess, probably the best I can do. Does that help a little bit? I had something else about drama I wanted to say, but it lost me. I'll think of it, or if someone else has a question. I think we have 1 minute left. Yeah, we do. Any last questions? Well, thank you so much for... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I'll just add to that. Would you say that story tends to engage the mind? Like, I love drama personally, so... But I wonder, does story, simple story, engage the mind to a fuller extent watching a drama? Do you think so or not?
Does simple story engage the mind as much or more than drama? It depends on the quality of the drama, I suppose. Quality of the storytelling. The wonderful thing about storytelling is you can, and I suppose drama too, but it is conversational in its best form, and it's interactive. And so maybe sometimes drama can be more of sort of a thing that is done at an audience without engaging it quite as much. I'm not sure about that. But that would be a difference I could think of, and it's a very important thing for me, is the interaction I have with you in that emotional space. Somebody has said, did I say that this time? Long after you forget the words I say, you'll remember how I made you feel. And that's something that's really important. I'm connecting a message with an emotion, and you're likelier to remember it. So if you have something important to teach or say, add some emotion to it, and it will go further. Thank you so much, and may your day be wonderful.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.